1930s, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of far. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Fireside Chats.
Hello again, Ironside Chatters. Say it with me now. Drinking a little drink, smoking a little smoke. From sunny San Diego, I'm Greg Carlwood, and I hope you're all tearing it up out there, fighting for your piece of the crag. Man, today's show is one I've been holding on to for a few weeks because the last couple I thought were more about things in the current news cycle, whereas this one is more about the war on human consciousness, the spiritual parasites of humanity, the hijacking of Freemasonry, and the ever-present manipulation of history, modern culture, and everything in between. Although I did bring up Ferguson and police brutality, but then again, just because it's out of the current news cycle doesn't really mean the problems with police are any better. And that said, it is also just good to have a friend on as a guest. Frederick is one of those guys I've gotten to know really well in the old conspiracy circle, and I know I'm better off for it. I think you guys are too, so let's just dive into it. The mysteries of Masonry, the secret war within it, the parasite that's sucking the energy out of the path of enlightenment, giants, Nephilim, archons, magic, and more, with the best of the best, Frederick.
The Higher Side Chats is where it's with everything you need to know, from corruption to UFOs. Be sure to grab your weed and let's look at some conspiracies on THC, the Higher Side Chats.
All right, folks, as we walk this winding road of reality and try to penetrate the global enchantment laid upon the population by the shadowy sorcerers of the power pyramid, we know our puzzle is far from complete, and to gather up more pieces, we rely on examining the connections of these major groups, as well as looking into the rare pockets of time where truth has surfaced unexpectedly. And lucky for us, today's guest is a good friend of mine with a natural tendency to unearth these very valuable fragments of the Big Bamboozle, and that is what we're talking about today. His name is Frederick, lecturer of esoteric philosophies, occult sciences, and mystery traditions. He's been a member of over 9 different esoteric orders, and he's written a brand new book hot off the presses called The Secret War Inside Freemasonry. You know him. You love him. Frederick, welcome back to THC.
Thank you, Greg. It's great to be back. I'm just really excited about our conversation today. I've been looking forward to it all day and last night, and it amazes me how long it's been since the last we spoke. I mean, of course, we've had our conversations in the ethosphere out there, you know, back and forth. But it has been a while since our last official conversation, so I'm really excited to catch up.
Yeah, man. Yeah. The last show we did was great. We also had a great time at the ParanoiaCon last year, checked out the local Scottish Rite Center, and also smoked a few bowls backstage with Jan Irvin before our big on-air blow-up.
Yeah, I actually have all that on audio, too, you know, to go through someday.
Yeah. It's weird how things turn out, but this should be a lot less hostile show, I think, and I'm pumped to have you here, man. I love the book. I think it clarifies a lot of the confusion people have, because even on this show, one week I'll interview a guy who is dead set on the idea that the Freemasons are the most evil organization on Earth, and then the next week I'll interview a guy who's been a Mason for 20 years and is more about sharing sacred geometry and ushering in enlightenment. So it can get a little unclear on who we can trust and who we can't when it comes to these secret societies, you know, and nailing down that aspect is a big part of it. And that's also a big part of your book, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. You know, it was, of course, my own personal voyage in the journey, the experience I tried to chronicle as best as possible and to be as objective as you can as a human being, you know, having emotions invested in your endeavors. It was always an experience that required great sacrifice of money and time and having a family and being committed to these lodges, you know, on one side. But at the same time, you know, trying to gain understanding of the myths and misconceptions woven into serious accounts and what was at the bottom of all this.
Yeah, man. And it turned out great. I think it's very clear when you get done with the book, who you should be looking at, who you should be pointing the finger at as a sketchy organization. But, you know, I did mention you've been in 9 esoteric orders, and sometimes people get sketched out on that. I've had people in the comments section of given episodes be like, you know, I only had to get halfway through your introduction to know that I couldn't trust this guy. And I don't want that to happen to you, my man. So at the ParanoiaCon, you disavowed your membership to these organizations. Why was that something you felt like you needed to do?
Well, as you've pointed out, it is a big knee-jerk reaction from a lot of people in the quote-unquote truther community or those who would know the truth about these things. And everyone, when they hear, wow, you were associated with all these orders, that's such a deep commitment to this thing. How can we trust your integrity or your authenticity with what you have to say? But I just remind everybody that I started out as one of those people who was skeptical and somebody who was questioning everything and coming at it from a negative point of view based on all the negative press that's easily harvested from any casual web search online. And I don't know about you, Greg, but I'm sure you and many of your listeners would agree with me here that what you get from the mainstream is oftentimes just, misconceptions and misinformation and disinformation mixed in with truth, mixed in with real accounts. And what I found is I needed to know. I did all that research. I found too many conflicting ideas, too much crossover stories of high virtues and great achievements and ideas of the best that humanity had to offer versus these dark occulted mystics doing satanic rituals and, you know, riding goats and killing babies or something and all this other crazy talk. And somewhere in the middle is the reality. And I was so fascinated and fixated before I finally realized, I discovered in my own family history, there was a long line of people who had already been associated with these initiatory rites. And in this conversation, we might get into a little bit of that metaphysical reality and whether there's any truth to the idea that there is a destiny that's in the genes or in the bloodline, you know, and that a person might be drawn and called to a thing on a metaphysical level, on a transcendental level that would cross over many lifetimes. And is there any truth to that? And could a person actually make contact with that in their own consciousness? And this is something that I don't get a lot into in the book. I do kind of allude to that a bit because I do mention my family history. But in reality, it kind of seems that there might be some truth to that. Of course, you combine that with the idea that there may be this universal social mind control program going on where the government, in league with many think tanks like the RAND Corporation or the SRI, are involved in impregnating or imprinting us all through collective telecommunications and media with the ideas of Masonic symbols and Egyptian iconography. And so maybe it was all contrived back in the 70s when I was a little boy, you know, watching television and listening to rock and roll. I mean, who knows, right?
Right.
But in the end, I had to know. I had to understand, Greg, and that's why I had to go in there and I had to allow myself to be initiated into these orders, and I reasoned it a couple of ways. Once I found out that I had this family history, I thought to myself, it's almost like destiny to go through an initiatory experience in some way in my lifetime to kind of link me up in what they call the brotherhood of the mystic tie, this intergenerational connection with others. And there's a many great thinkers in Western civilization who claimed that they were also initiates in the mysteries. And that is what Freemasonry and these other Western orders in America and in the British Isles, that was what they claim to be, is ancient light in modern times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, man, I get it. I have nothing wrong with that exploration. I find it to be just a body of knowledge. And when you have that knowledge, you can use it to enslave or you can use it to enjoy your life and kind of take the reins of your own universe. And that's a noble thing. But I did want to talk to you a little bit about your personal experiences as a Mason. We did talk about this in person. I even filmed a little bit of you talking about it, but I couldn't use it because the fans in the room were too loud. But you have had a few experiences with police that were you just an average Joe, you might have gotten a ticket or even been taken to jail. But because you were part of the club, that didn't happen, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So you want me to tell one of those stories? Is that what you're saying?
Please. Yeah. Let people get jealous.
Okay. Well, here's one. The first time I ever really experienced that sort of like cronyism or nepotism or whatever you want to call it. And being somebody as a working class person in life, you know, I always struggled in America with like having ID and cash and paychecks and getting, you know what I mean? Getting the money at on payday so you can go buy stuff you want to buy. Right. And you always like, you don't have the proper ID, or you have to have three forms of ID, or you don't have a bank account here, so we're going to charge you, or we're not even going to let you cash it, or all the crazy things you go through. So I've been through all those too. Right. And then I join a lodge in this local city in the Midwest. And I find myself on a Friday afternoon at almost 5 o'clock across town from my house without my wallet. I don't have any ID, but I have a paycheck. And I don't want the whole paycheck. I just need like $50, you know what I mean, to put gas in the car and get a six pack of beer or whatever and go back to the house, you know. But I won't make it in time to get that wallet, to get to the bank, to get the money in the bank and get them to give me back the $50. So I go into a local branch where I'm aware that the president of this bank in this city is a brother Mason. He happens to be the master of the lodge where I'm in, and I'm in the line. And we were just sitting in the bank on the other side of town last Sunday rehearsing the ritual for the lodge. So I know this guy's name, and I walk in and I just go up to the teller. I don't have an ID. I have a payroll check with no ID, and I'm walking in off the street. I walk up to this young kid, a college age kid, and I'm like, look, I don't have any ID. I need to deposit this check and I need $50 back, and I don't have any ID, but I am a close associate of the president of the bank. So I'm hoping that you guys will be able to work with me. And I do have a bank account here, and I can tell you my name and my social security number and all that stuff. And the old gentleman standing behind the teller heard me say I'm a close associate of the president of the bank. And he goes, really, how are you associated? And I said, well, I sit in Lodge Blank, you know, and with him on the line. And he goes, really? He reaches around the corner and gives me the secret handshake and says, I'm from Lodge so-and-so. How can I help you, brother? And I walked out of there with $50 in my deposited check, a slip for the check. So I could have been somebody that, you know, completely lying. He didn't verify any of that. I could have stolen that check, walked in there, said I was that person. If I knew the secret handshake, said what I said and walked out with $50, you know, right off the street. I got away with that.
I find that amazing, man. It's something that people need to realize, that the rules are only applicable to those that aren't in the club. And, you know, we don't need to get into all the experiences, but I know there are a couple with police. You know, you've been pulled over without a license, give them the hand signals, show them the badge, and you're good to go. And that's kind of the angle that I really got thinking about this morning, because I see a lot of people, the big thing going on right now, a lot of people are talking about Ferguson and police brutality, but people are kind of missing the mark if they don't experience it in their own life, that they don't realize police and the system, banking system, is also very entangled with all this. They don't treat people equally. You know, if you're a member of that same lodge, then you get special privileges, you get a free pass, and even just being white does offer its advantages. And it makes me so mad to hear people spouting off online with things like, well, I don't see a problem, the police always treat me fine. Well, not everyone experiences the same reality, bro. So maybe you should just stay out of this one, because it isn't your fight. And I think those examples and having the privilege in masonry also just goes to show there are layers to how the system is going to treat you. And if you are black, you might be on one of those lower rungs. And yeah, I'd be upset too.
Absolutely. I mean, we live in a stratosphered society. It is a class system. I was raised to believe that it was a classless society, but that's a false premise. Mm-hmm. We live in a class system where clearly there's castes that are set. And I grew up in a small town in New England where they had a golden circle. That's what they called it, just like the Knights of the Golden Circle that we talk about. And I had never heard of the Knights of the Golden Circle when I already knew about the golden circle in the hometown. And it's the fact that that same town where you talk about getting pulled over. I mean, I live in a town where a quarter or a third of the police department were brother Masons in the line. So some of them I outranked in the lodge, and yet they're officers on the force pulling me over. So see, there's a little conflict of interest there, right? Mm-hmm. And I would get away with things because of that. And other people were even worse. I mean, you know, people could drive by a policeman wearing just a bathrobe and no shoes, flying 100 miles an hour. If he was in that golden circle, they'd just be like, they'd motion to him to slow down, you know, as he went by. There'd be no ticket. There'd be no shakedown. There'd be no racial profiling. There'd be no brutalization. There'd be no violation of civil rights whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And that's what you're addressing. And it is connected to this whole thing. You know, we started this conversation talking about this book I released. And one of the chapters in the book is A Secret War on Human Consciousness. Mm-hmm. And what we know is that we have the architects of our paradigm. They're controlling. The police are a brutal priesthood that reinforces the paradigm with the whip and the stick These are the ones that last. This is where the rubber meets the road, literally. And if you are out of line, they will knock you back into line. And, you know, people think that I had the same conversation. You were just talking about debating with people who try to dismiss it as, well, I'm glad the police are out there. You know, if you aren't doing anything wrong, then you got nothing to fear. Well, what about the falsely accused? And right. What about the racially profiled? And, you know, oh, the justice system is blah, blah, blah. No, it's not. The justice system is corrupt. And we live in a society where you can buy your way out. OJ proved that, you know, anybody, you can get away with murder, you know, and this is just one high profile case in a situation where we know on the local level, people violate other people all the time in many various ways, their rights and their person, and get away with it because they're privileged. You know, like the various dark cases of the Kennedys or any other dynastic family that's afflicted themselves upon the American culture. And they've, you know, left victims in their wake because they're rich and privileged. This is the culture we live in. And I grew up in that little town where it was a resort town. So there was a high caliber of people who had huge houses on the water. Johnny Depp's got a house in my hometown, you know? And so this is the scene that I grew up in where you had people who were working class folk right next to people who drove, you know, the kids drove Mercedes to high school, you know, and they drove Bentleys, you know, and these are teenagers, you know, they had credit cards and stuff. They had more nicer clothes than the parents of the working class kids. And so there's also a high rate of suicide in this town because that secret war on human consciousness is convincing everyone that, you know, to be rich, to be wealthy and to be able to buy all the products. That's really the goal, right? I mean, that's really enlightenment. And in America, that's the enlightened state, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
That's the human excelsior, you know, homo excelsior state is to be successful and rich and have all the trappings. But in the end, we know that can't be satisfying because we hear all the cases of people who take their lives, who have everything, you know, perceived. I have a friend who inherited millions of dollars when he was 16 years old. He killed himself when he was 29. You know, I mean, 13 years later. So he had everything. He killed himself in his Maserati, you know.
Oh, my God.
So this is the world. That, and then when you hear about the Heath Ledgers or the Chris Farleys or the any other number of celebrities, the Robin Williams who have everything. And it really doesn't pay off because the bottom line to that, what they're selling, that myth of progress is shallow. Isn't it, you know?
Right. Yeah, they got us chasing a false enlightenment.
Yeah, and those of us who drink the Kool-Aid and buy into that, who give ourselves willingly over to that pursuit of materialism, that so-called pursuit of happiness that's talked about in the sacred papers of America, right? Mm-hmm. Well, when we give into that, I think a lot of times we are disappointed, which is why, in the end, we want to cultivate some sort of richer inner experience. And this is what we talked about, you know, also amidst all the other, you know, that the conspiracy con, at the paranoia con, throwing ideas around about the dark cult of mystics. We also talked about the hope of enlightenment and the true idea of non-compliance, right, Greg?
Right.
Of, you know, writing this book, I am in my own way a revolutionary because I put forth an experience where I infiltrated these lodges. I went in there and I learned their secrets. And I come to everyone right now today and I say, guess what? Two things. Number one, the guys inside the lodge barely know what they have. They barely understand anything, number one. And number two, they don't corner the market on enlightenment, guys. What you think they possess, you already possess, just like all of us. It's just unrealized potential within us all.
Amen, man. Well said. And I love that the term midlife crisis, because to me, that's just when you finally wake up. You know, you don't get to go back in time and get your life back, but you realize that you're 3/4 of the way through the race and you don't even want to keep running. You know, that's what the midlife crisis really signifies to me.
Absolutely.
Even calling the police a brutal priesthood. I love it. And being my Masonic authority, I had to ask you about this because I saw this online. You know, a lot of people with this, you know, not to harp on this Ferguson thing, but a lot of people are saying the elite are trying to usher in this race war, perhaps. And that, well, in fact, may be true. I'm not sure, but I'm also not sure if you saw this, but my man Isaac Weishaupt, who's been on the show before from IlluminatiWatcher.com, he posted a piece about how this hands up, don't shoot hand sign actually has its roots in masonry. Apparently, it's called the Grand Hailing Sign of Distress. And the fact that this is now coming up in a different way, it's kind of weird. It might be a nod to some of those powerful people that shows that it is being manufactured, perhaps.
Absolutely. The Grand Hailing Sign of Distress. Basically, it is the hands up, don't shoot sign, but it's a three-stage descent from that point. So you put your hands at your side, you raise them up, and then they say, you know, oh Lord God, is there no hope for the widow's son? Mm-hmm. And as you say those words, you lower your hands in two stages to the middle and then down to your sides. So that's the sign that Joseph Smith supposedly gave before they mowed him down with rifles.
Right.
You know, and he jumped out the second floor of the Carthage courthouse to his death, along with his brother Hiram. So this is, you know, they say that there was Masonic rings wielding the fingers of the triggers of those rifles, you know. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, right. This is a Grand Hailing Sign of Distress, is like a gang sign you'd throw down at that checkpoint if you're trying to escape from some, you know, social upheaval or whatever, or you're being intercepted by a law enforcement official or other military official, because don't forget, many, many military people or personnel are also brother Masons. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, there's female orders too. There's co-masonry, which accepts women, and then there's the sub-orders, the subordinate orders to Freemasonry that have women, the Job's Daughters and the Order of the Eastern Star. But I wanted to get back to one of the questions I don't think I answered the second part of, and the reason why I felt a need to expose the secrets of Freemasonry, because, and I just mentioned women, you know, that's one of the reasons is because women are excluded from Freemasonry, as if there's this archaic patriarchal idea that women don't deserve the light of Freemasonry. Mm-hmm. For some reason, they're subordinate or undeserving. And that's so Victorian and older and so outdated that it really, it begs to be pointed at and derided, I think, and criticized as an approach that needs to be let go of. It doesn't really hold water, that idea. But the second reason is because Freemasonry came forth as this light to man, right? We're bringing forth these ideas, the light, the mysteries of ancient times. And I really feel like in human society, especially here in America and also in the British Isles, that Freemasonry has failed to bring that light, that it's actually instead contributed to the darkness and has brought about the chaos that then it will then bring forth some false order that's contrived and designed to control us all.
Yeah, man. And that is a big revelation that came out in your book. I mean, a lot of people might have that impression, but to actually have been on the inside, you know, it's a more respectable opinion, a more educated opinion. And to get into the details of kind of the overarching theme of the book, when you do unravel all this tangled up information on Masonry and you see these connections and you separate the true history from what some of these groups are doing, they're trying to manufacture backdate history for their own purposes. When you look at all this, who do you see as the major troublemakers in this saga?
Okay, well, there is in fact a group of individuals that we knowingly refer to as the Illuminati. But this is not how they would label themselves, and this is not how they were labeled officially, you know, in their whatever organizations they would find themselves in. But for mm-hmm. the sake of discussion and for the sake of giving people an idea of what we're talking about, there is an Illuminati-like organism that has traveled down riding sidecar along with human history. You know, and it all goes back to a time, probably the early days after a great cataclysm. Mm-hmm. And I broke this down in other works I've done besides this book. I've talked about it, you know, the idea that in the last days of the flood, you know, the waters receded and the wet mud still stood on the lands, who would be, you know, the most important people to know? Mm-hmm. If not the builders and architects, right? The people who could rebuild. Mm-hmm. They're the guys you want around. So their tools became an integral part of the allegories of all these secret societies for a reason. And they drew upon these traditions because a lot of these orders also drew their traditions from the ancient Roman Commissine guilds. The Commissine guilds were the cathedral builders, the early cathedral builders and the great architects of ancient times. And they had hermetics, the science of the occult forbidden arts woven into there. you know, and that is at the root of all these orders. You know, at the basis of it all, you have this need to keep things in symmetry, this idea of reflecting the divine, and the idea of attracting excellence. It's all woven into a myth that's dangled like a carrot to the everyman who walks in the door of a lodge. And behind it are these orders. And so you ask, who is it? Well, I can tell you from in my book, I speak a lot in the histories. Freemasonry, ancient craft masonry, as we understand it, is born in the British Isles in the early 1700s. It quickly migrates to the continent. And when it migrates to the continent, it explodes like an infection. It becomes an amazing phenomenon of what they call the generation of multi-degrees that basically turn into, well, an average French or German itinerant Mason, a man traveling from village to village if he had that, you know, a trade, or if he was just a shiftless wanderer or whatever, you know. He could travel from town to town and show up in a local lodge if he was already a brother Mason in the first 3 degrees. He could bring these extra numerary degrees with him and sell them, peddle them to the other Masons in the lodge. So he would basically sell them pieces of paper with fancy seals on them and archaic symbols and words, and teach them a few secret handshakes and give them some pseudo history and a secret word. And then they pay him like a couple bucks, you know, and he'd go on to the next town. And that would be his industry, really, you know, the degree peddlers. And so that's one aspect of it. But eventually this tradition all produced hundreds and thousands of various degrees that kind of organized in these little councils and rites and orders. That's what these words mean. They're like the grouping up of degrees into different traditions and keeping them together in these little groups, a hierarchy of forms around the group. And then the leadership, you know, asserts its authority. And so that's what all the various histories of all these varying degrees and rites and orders and all this is connected to, different leaderships vying for authority and control over the either Freemasonry proper, ancient craft masonry, or some other sub group of it, you know, some other side group. And the Scottish Rite is a huge part of this. Yes. The Scottish Rite was one of these groups that it born out of that same European tradition. The Scottish Rite was implanted. It was sort of injected or inoculated into the American culture in the late 18th century in the form of what was called the Ineffable Degrees, or the Lodge of Perfection, you know, the Rite of Perfection. And so it sort of evolved in the early days before the Civil War, and then through and after the Civil War, it evolved into the Scottish Rite. It was first called the Scottish Rite in 1861 by Albert Pike, very, very infamous / famous, you know, Civil War brigadier general who, you know, ends up being basically the guy who really puts the Scottish Rite on the map. Mm-hmm. So to speak. And in my book, we map it out. We talk about the Scottish Rite agents at odds with what we call the York Rite, which is the more Americanized version of that ancient craft masonry that was brought over here in the early 18th century by English soldiers, a lot of them in sojourner lodges where the military would bring over versions of masonry that they carried with them into the colonies. And then they would convert the locals, they'd initiate them into the lodge, and then they would form a lodge right there in that local area. And that's how lodges were transplanted into the colonies.
Interesting, yeah. I think it's such a fascinating saga, a lot of infiltration. It seems to be kind of their same blueprint for control, just applied to infiltrating secret societies and getting in there, just like they might have done with the, you know, the 60s revolution. You get in there, you infiltrate it, you steer people to where you want them steered. Basically, in Scottish Rite, it seems like they just get people to continue paying their dues and walk along a road to nowhere because they kind of dangle that carrot and it never really comes. It seems to be what I gathered out of Scottish Rite. And so it begs the question, on those upper levels, what are they doing with all that money? They're a huge organization. You know, they've definitely had their tentacles in a lot of different areas.
Yeah, there's all kinds of crazy stories about what happens with all the money they gather up. They claim to the world that they donate they give over $1.5 million a day, I believe, to charitable endeavors. Let's talk about Masonic Charities for just a moment. The idea of Masonic Charity began in the colonies of America with the notion that Masons helped one another. Written right within the initiatory obligations of the first 3 degrees in Masonry, you continually reinforce, restate, you know, reestablish that you will fly to the general relief of a Freemason, a brother Mason who is in distress, you know, when you're able to do so and it won't cause you distress. And you'll do it immediately, especially if he applies to you for help. So this tenet was carried out by the early Masons in America. So if a brother Mason down the road, imagine a colony setting, we're all homesteading really, and you know, I'm down the road and we're both in the lodge and you need something, I'd come help you. And that got around. Well, in a small colony community, if another person who wasn't in the lodge needed help in those situations, the average person out there today is pretty egalitarian, I think, and they would help somebody they saw in need if it really wasn't going to hurt them too bad, you know? And that's what would happen. And eventually this idea, this notion of charitable endeavor began, but it always kind of stayed at that local level until around 1825, I believe it was, when a certain Captain William Morgan disappeared on September 11th, by the way. when he disappeared, Freemasonry almost got shut down in America. It's basically because what it was found out after the fact was that several Masons not only abducted him, but they were involved in law enforcement and covered it up. And so, you know, it was a drawn out trial. People don't realize it went on for years. There was dozens of indictments and many Masons did go to jail. But no one was ever found guilty of murder. They were only ever found guilty of abduction. And you know, William Morgan was never seen again. After that time, Freemasonry shut down in places like Vermont, New Hampshire, and New York for a while, where it's completely deactivated. But as it began to resurface, and there was also a huge social uproar, a giant anti-Mason party, which was the first third party in America, became the result of this anti-Mason fervor that rose up from what happened in a place called Batavia, New York, in the Hudson River Valley region. Same place where the Sleepy Hollow, you know, and same place where Joseph Smith came from, which was Palmyra, right next door. So, you know, we also stayed there. Mater X and I stayed there when we drove across country in the 90s, late 90s. We stayed in that same area, ironically, as where the Captain William Morgan disappeared. But when that happened, they needed to churn out some sort of huge, you can imagine, right, Greg? They had to churn out some sort of huge PR campaign to turn this around, you know? Well, how are we going to spin this? You know? So Masons began to give away stuff like nobody's business, right? I mean, that's really why they're out there celebrating all the charitable part of it, is they're helping people to put a good look on it, right? That's the surface. But then behind the scenes, we've talked to guys that are insiders in the leadership. I mean, there were people who were talking to me. I interviewed a lot of people who wouldn't let me use their name. You know, they wouldn't let me reveal the source. And I didn't include some of that stuff in the book because I didn't want to just throw out all kinds of baseless, you know, stuff without verification. But I can tell everybody right now that I heard all kinds of stories of corruption and nepotism, and I heard stories of where they transferred funds back and forth between Masonic organizations as a laundering, you know, a back and forth to where you could lose thousands of dollars in the exchange here and there. And it's all connected to this. It's all hearsay right now on the radio. I mean, who am I? I'm just telling you what other people told me. But the fact of the matter is that there's even anybody out there who was, these people were high up leadership connected. This isn't just idle information. These are people that the average person's not going to get to say these things, right, you know? And so that's what we're dealing with.
Man. So let's make it weird for a second. Let's get to some weird places. What are your thoughts on the idea that at the top of these fraternal orders, they're usually participating in some kind of sustained ongoing contact with some non-human entities? Do you think that's a big part of the high-level secrets, or is that just rumors?
No, and you know, we covered this a little bit in our last conversation. I feel like there's some huge substantiation to this. I think that there's quite the possibility, because from all of my researches and experiences, and I've really looked at this a lot, Greg, I think that there is the greatest possibility of a sustained contact, as you put it, from ritualized behavior with disembodied spirits. That's mm-hmm. absolutely plausible in my universe anyways.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, man.
Well, let's break it down a little for the listeners to kind of get more specific about what we're talking about here. So there's a book out there called Inside the Magical Lodge, written by a guy named John Michael Greer. And in this book, he is a man who's spent decades working in the Golden Dawn magical system, where they do ritual ceremonial magic on a regular basis, which means they have a lodge space that they banish the energy. They literally cleanse the energy, creating a vacuum on an etheric level. And we're getting weird, right? Mm-hmm. On an ambient energetic level, they just cleanse this area. And what it's like, Greg, it's like if you were to, like in Dragon Ball Z, right? The protective bubble around the characters, right? That's what, like, you'd imagine a 9-foot sphere around you, where you're saying, I'm holding back all the cosmic energies in the universe for this time while I'm doing this magical ritual. They'll all hold back outside that sphere. And then you'll say, I now allow only this version of magic, or this version of energy, this current of energetic force to come into the circle, and I work with it now. And then I'll bring in this elemental force and I'll work with it now. You know, so you're basically, and then at the end of it all, when you banish the circle again, when you're done, all the energies of the cosmos splash back into that space, because nature abhors a vacuum and rushes back in. And if you've done your magic right, according to the magical tradition, the will, the thing that you've manifested with your will be buoyant in that current of cosmos and be carried to its destination, its likely course, where it's supposed to go, what you want to accomplish, what the outcome, the results you seek. So this guy, John Michael Greer, he had years and years of experience in doing this sort of thing with groups of people in lodges, because the Golden Dawn, as with the OTO, as with hundreds of other magical orders, they meet in Masonic lodges in every city and state, you know, city and town in America.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what people need to keep in mind when you think, well, a guy will come on and say, hey, Masons are just guys having barbecues and they're, you know, they're doing this and that. It's just about bake sales and pancake breakfasts and that's all it really is. And, you know, raising funds and money charities for the children's funds and all that. That's all well and fine. That may be just quite so. But they also rent that space the other nights of the week when they're not meeting to other quasi-Masonic organizations. And some of those include the OTO, which was founded by, or at least brought to America by, Aleister Crowley, and the Golden Dawn, which is all the Victorian magicians from, you know, Scotland, Ireland, and England, and other places in Europe, who also brought it over here to America. So it's a lot of stuff's going on there that may not be, you know, quite what people expect in a Masonic lodge on any given night of the week. And so ceremonial magic is part of this, Greg. And this book he wrote called Inside the Magical Lodge talks about how a ritual space, a Masonic lodge, which has an altar, which has a square box in the center of the room with the three lights of masonry around it. And, you know, each wall in the room is a direction on the compass, you know, north, south, east, and west. And there's a chair there and there's a station there. And that's all in accordance with this idea of crossroad governors or demons, you know, like the idea of there being 91 parts to the earth that are all divided on this grid. And at every spot, there's a governor, a king, and a prince. And that's what the words are used according to John Dee's system. And you end up with this idea of these entities, these disembodied spirits, who literally govern that exact spot on the earth. So if you built a lodge, for example, on one of those really potent gridline crisscross places where you have a dozen governors and kings and princes of the demonic world, and demon in the Greek means disembodied spirit. Daemon is a disembodied spirit, you know. So if you had a building that you built on that spot, or a temple, you know, or a church, and then everybody met regularly, weekly, daily, monthly, and all these holy days, and on the specific calendrical days when everything, you know, works in a cycle, right? So you have all the zodiacal signs aligning and you all come together and you do a ritual. That attracts disembodied spirits. That brings disembodied spirits to that spot over and over again. And after a while, they'll take on a life of their own and they'll start to keep, they want to keep that gathering going. They want to keep that activity going. They want to attract new members. They want to bring the same like-minded people into that room and keep them coming back. So you see how that would just keep evolving.
Right. Yeah, man. And this idea of magic and these organizations, I like the interface between that and money. And you write a little bit about the Bankster Thugs in this book, and we talked a little bit about it last time, but it's such an interesting area to me because obviously the whole world is operated by money, but it wasn't always. Finance and commerce had to be invented. And when you look back and you see this super close association between religions and monetary systems, priests and money changers, it makes me even more intrigued by this idea that money might be the ultimate magic. It might be some direct manifestation from this sustained contact of this like spiritual parasite, because it operates with almost the same quality of possession in our world. I mean, what do you think?
Well, absolutely. Money is the talismanic tool of the mind parasites, right? Of the invading pathogen that has entered human consciousness at some point along our journey, you know, as a species, this outside or inner or outer, you know, intra species or outer species predator showed up. And one of the tools that is used is this mystification, this captivation through sigil, through talisman, through money, money, the dollar itself. I mean, the symbols all over it. It's you know, fascinating to think about in an objective way. But of course, subjectively, we're enslaved by it. It's absolutely correct. I still am struggling with a way around this. And let's not be mistaken to all the listeners out there. You know, my motivation to know the truth and to find the truth, there was a mercenary side to it, guys. I mean, I wanted to be on the advantage side instead of the disadvantage side because I felt disempowered as a person. I felt completely out of touch with all this metaphysical reality or the idea of any of this elemental nature or any of it being real. It was all fantastical and not clearly not in my everyday experience, you know, as a person in the social structure of America, working and slaving away, trying to pay the bills. But I felt like I sought some sort of advantage. I wanted to be re-empowered. And I thought to myself, if they're using these tools, and I believe that they are the birthright of all of ours, Western people, you know, you, Greg, I assume you're Anglo-Saxon, you know, descent mostly, just like me.
Sure.
So we are of those, what I call the European tribal peoples, you know, like the ones that were conquered in the same way the Plains Indians of America were conquered. These European people were conquered 1,000 years before by the same sort of church system. That Abrahamic religious infestation, which tries to tell us all that we're fallen and we need redemption and we need salvation, you know, and not that we're born with everything we need and we just need to wake up and realize it, you know. And so you asked about the power brokers. All ever since this particular paradigm was launched, which probably happened 10,000 years ago, just to throw a number out there. Ever since it was launched, we've had a priesthood in place that has used money or currency in some form. You know, the exchange of goods and services has been a part of this plan. The accumulation of wealth, the creation of scarcity and shortage in order to get people enslaved to others, you know, and the maintaining of that myth of scarcity and shortage to keep everybody really reinforcing that paradigm. And in America, it was no different. With the end of the revolution, you know, you had America wide open. And everybody knows that the central banking in America was established. They had the charter signed before the Treaty of Paris. Before they stopped the war between America and England, they already had a central bank for the new government set up. That's how important this was, right? And this is the priority. And who was the guy that was brokering that deal, everybody? Our old friend Alexander Hamilton, who obviously had connections with the Rothschilds and the foreign banking exchanges. And this Rothschild connection, I only know what I've read, just like everybody else has read, the Anthony Sutton books out there and all the other material that anybody could find to talk about what we think is going on there. Whether or not any of that's true, what I know is the results. You know, the results are that a central bank was set up in America that basically just totally extracted the wealth everywhere around it to the point where it left such financial ruin in its wake. It wasn't they did not renew the charter for that central bank. Mm-hmm. That tells you that wasn't effective for the people who thought they had liberty in America. But this is how it moves forward, everybody. And everybody, when you think about the assassinated presidents in American history, you know, the only president in American history to ever fight the central bank and not be shot in the head in public was Andrew Jackson. You know, right. he's the only one. And that's we remember Andrew Jackson.
And they honor him by putting him on the fiat currency he was against.
Exactly. And what do we remember about him? He was a general. He had an army, a standing army around him at all times, a cavalry. Now, that's how he enforced his policies, really, you know. And of course, right, in the end, the irony is he's on the currency. So they win.
Right. It's a fascinating thread. And the Knights Templar are a big part of it. If you go back further, I know you were kind of involved. I think that was one of the groups you were affiliated with, the modern Knights Templar. But in the past, it's a pretty fascinating story because, as I understand it, they amassed a lot of wealth using banking tricks and issuing credit. And then when King Philip tortured them and burned them at the stake, they had to disclose a lot of where those ideas came from. And they kept mentioning rituals, these communing with some kind of entities that guided them. And it seems to be one of those rare times where we get the kind of insight we're looking for into this thread.
Okay, so there's two parts to this question, and the answers are really manifold. Because we have to consider, okay, what we know about torture, right? I mean, I've never been tortured, like, officially by any, you know, standard that you could, you know, set as a torture standard. That's never happened to me. I don't know about you, Greg.
Right.
But I can imagine, from what I've heard described and read described, that, you know, if I was tortured, I would just say whatever I had to say to get it to stop. And that's what happened with these Knights Templar. I mean, they literally burned the bottom of their feet till the bones fell out. That's how it's described. With hot irons. So they melted the bottom of their feet until the little bones in their feet fell out onto the floor. So these are the guys that they got all that information written down from.
Fair point. It's good. I guess it's worth noting that.
We got to note that ahead of time. Okay. But having said that, there was absolutely something heretical going on within the Knights Templar of old. Absolutely. We know that is the case. We've verified that. But as to the specifics that were gotten from the torture confessions, I don't know how much I can, you know, deny or support there because of that fact about torture, you know.
Right.
But putting that aside for a second, we know that the Templars were absolutely the early bankers. They set up a currency. So basically, if you were a rich noble in Europe, you wanted to go to the Crusades, you wanted to go to the Holy Land or whatever, you could go to the local Templar commandery and you could, you know, deposit amount of gold in their commandery. They would give you a sigillated piece of, you know, CD, a certificate of deposit that would have their fancy seal on it. And you could travel anywhere where there was another Templar commandery and cash it in for gold. Mm-hmm. And that was the early currency exchange. So they had that. Now, the order I belong to is a little bit tricky because the Masonic Knights Templar order is not the original order of Knights Templar. Okay. It's not at all. I mean, the ideas of the Holy Blood, Holy Grail, notwithstanding any of that, because within the statement, I must qualify that there is, I believe, another, you know, almost secret Templar tradition that's traveling right alongside the official Masonic Knights Templar order that may have connections that go all the way back, at least to King Robert the Bruce and his battle at Bronach Burn, where this mysterious cavalry shows up and everybody claims that's the Knights Templar who had fled from the betrayal of Pope Clement and King Philip the Fair in France. So that's the story. And I've heard it too, but what I can tell you is, as being a former member of the Masonic Knights Templar in America, is that order is not the original Knights Templar order. You know, what it is a paramilitary order from like the Victorian era, you know, Civil War mentality in America, you know. And as a matter of fact, Mark Twain, he said that Walter Scott, who wrote Ivanhoe, and also wrote Rob Roy, should be blamed for the Civil War because he infested the Southern mind with this idea of chivalry and the idea of these knights riding across the land like Arthurian knights doing good deeds and saving damsels and, you know, defending Dixie and all this. And this was like the core. And so in the end of the end days of that time period in America, if you most people were affected by the Civil War. Most men who were able-bodied served. And so they got that experience. But for those who didn't, they could join a paramilitary order like the Knights Templar in America and rub elbows with the former Civil War veterans as equals, doing drills, formations, and marching in paramilitary outfits that looked like Civil War officers. Mm-hmm. So that was really what it was going on there. And that's where we have this infestation of the Illuminati that we alluded to before when I talked about Albert Pike. Albert Pike had an associate in Europe named Carlo Mazzini. Mazzini was the head of the Italian Illuminati, quote unquote, mm-hmm. You know, the inheritors of that same tradition. And what tradition are we talking about? We're not talking about the specific system, the ideology of Adam Weishaupt. What he presented was a utopian ideology. What we're talking about is the playbook he used to disseminate his order, which was they attached themselves to Freemasonry and they recruited from the rank and file of Freemasonic lodges in Bavaria mm-hmm. at the time. And that's exactly what Mazzini did. He did the same thing in Italy, and they created what were called Young Italy lodges. And these young Italians were recruited from the ranks and brought into what was like almost like mind control, like Chautauqua in America in the 1800s, in the 19th century, where they traveled around from city to city and sort of like disseminated mind control protocols almost, you know, like it's basically social engineering. You know, they're putting out information that's government contrived or contrived by the architects who are trying to get a desired social result. Mm-hmm. And so Mazzini's was to spread insurrection, to spread revolution, you know, and he was part of that revolutionary spirit. And he definitely had a specific agenda in mind. And being a friend of Albert Pike's over here in America, Albert Pike was not only the head of the Scottish Rite, he was also one of the heads of the Knights of the Golden Circle. That's how America found out about the Knights of the Golden Circle, because of the Lincoln assassination trials. It was all brought out. And maybe we can get into that more, you know, in the second hour here, right? We can talk more about the ways in which Albert Pike and Mazzini brought, you know, all of this, their specific agenda on board and recruited from the rank and file of Freemasonry.
Yeah, right on. We definitely can do that. But man, another element of Masonry that comes out in the conspiracy world that I'm kind of curious about, I want to ask you about, is this idea of the deity flip, that at the highest degrees in Masonry or even within the order of the church, you eventually learn that if they let you get high enough, that a negative entity is what's really being worshipped, a negative god, rather than this all-loving god they preach about. And this kind of gets into the idea that Lucifer is the good guy and Yahweh is the bad, but I find it pretty interesting. Can you give us any insight there as to what's going on?
Well, again, I think we're back at that whole 91 parts of the earth and the crossroad demons and the different grades that when I talked about governors, kings, and princes, this terminology is a way to designate a different level in a hierarchy. You know, so this is the thinking.
Right. Good.
Right. Okay. So these individuals, they're really operating with this belief that they think in terms of a hierarchical setup for power. And that's really what we're talking about here is power, elemental power. And so the fact that the idea of a reversal of deity, I like that terminology because it's subtle. It really is. When you come into a lodge system and you start going through the first 3 degrees, there's no indication of anything of the sort. You really don't get that. You get this good old boy experience with a bunch of Methodists. Really. I mean, that's mm-hmm. what it feels like. Yeah. It feels like you're in church almost. It's that sort of boring kind of vibration going on. And a lot of it's sort of silly and hokey and it seems lighthearted. But when you get into the higher degrees and start to get into the invitational orders, that's when the black cloaks with the hoods come out and the burning incense and the candles, you know, and the strange symbols appear on the altar. You know, this, the triangles and the circles and the stars become more emphasized with the different anagrammical words, you know, so it's like a sigil. And it seems like you have these polyhedrons and these strange mandala-like geometrical patterns are all of a sudden applied to the ritual. And all of these things coax the awareness and the consciousness into a certain kind of frequency vibration. So it's completely plausible what you're saying, that the individuals at the core of this, the leadership, in fact, would be contriving a system in which they could literally attract certain energetic forms, certain frequency vibrations to get what? To get more power.
Right.
Right? I mean, a conduit to harvest power from individuals, average individuals.
Yeah, it's super compelling because it also explains why rumors of really dark things like pedophilia and human sacrifice plague the upper deck of these powerful groups. I mean, even Jesus on the cross eating his flesh and drinking his blood, that is a mock human sacrifice every Sunday morning in the typical church, you know, but it's so subtle because it's based in tradition and we don't challenge it. We don't ask questions as to why we're eating the flesh of this guy we worship, because I don't do that in my everyday life. But when you go to the church, that's what's going on. So it really does make me wonder.
Well, yeah, the idea of sacrifice is a deep-seated issue in our consciousness. There's so much to just like a whole other show. We can talk about the what's really going on there as far as what we're dealing with people who buy into that ideology, and then the effects of it on all of us, whether we even know it or not. You know, what we're suffering under the consensual reality that is formed over time when enough people believe a thing and it's reinforced in the quote unquote collective consciousness and unconsciousness, and everybody's sort of buying into it after a while. And the idea of, okay, so what it breaks down to is like this. You have linkages between all things in the universe. There was a guy named Bruno who was a medieval hermeticist, and he wrote a lot about these linkages, the correspondences between things. And he believed that magic, the idea of magic, which defined magic merely means causing change in accordance with will, whether you mean physically or just in the level of consciousness, mm-hmm. It's causing change in accordance with will. That's all magic is in the by definition. So having said that, Bruno believed that magic was fueled by something, a force, an electrical grid or whatever, that he termed Eros. Like love from the Latin. So Eros, right? Or is it Greek? Maybe Greek. But the idea of this energy fueling these linkages, these correspondences between different things, all things in the universe, whether living, organic, or inorganic. So the idea of this was, it paints a picture when you think about people who are involved in twisted pedophilia or deviant sexual practices or just the strange stuff we hear that people end up doing in an occult-like fashion. Because what we find is that if this is so, in this medieval model that Bruno establishes, that there is these linkages between all things in the universe, and that it's fueled in the energy used to run the system that brings about desired results, desired effects, the changes in accordance with will, is this Eros, this love, quote unquote, love energy. Well, how closely tied is that love energy to sexuality? Right?
Right.
So you can see, you can understand on that level, not that I'm at all condoning any of this. Please, I hope no one misunderstands what I'm saying, because I'm not. What I'm saying is, this is a way to understand why these people would go down these twisted roads, because they're trying to access power through this method, this hermetic occult method.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point that I really hadn't heard articulated yet. To get back to the book a little bit, and Scottish Rite specifically, I mean, it seems like they're kind of a Trojan horse of secret societies. I mean, you pay your dues, you do the rituals, but it's just a long road to nowhere while the upper deck is rewriting history and putting themselves in positions of authority and amassing power on your dime. And it's like a big pyramid scheme. And last time we talked a little bit about the giants and the mounds that were found in early America and the Smithsonian's role in that. And it's kind of like the Scottish Rite is the Smithsonian of secret societies, because they're both just fronts positioned as authorities in their field, and they're secretly destroying or hiding the real gold nuggets.
That is a great analogy. It's exactly like that. And I am firmly convinced, I'll say, with no substantiation to prove this, that within the House of the Temple in Washington, D.C., there's probably the greatest Masonic secrets that I would love to get my hands on to check out. And because they're holding them completely sequestered. You know, it's just like we joked about last time, and I think we might have talked this time about the idea of just being put away into that big room where they keep the Ark of the Covenant and the Spear of Destiny. You know what I mean? With all the boxes with no labels.
Yeah, I mean, the Vatican vault is another area where I'd love to get my hands on.
Exactly. And because we know that we only have probably, like, you know, I'm not going to be specific, but in all generalities, you know, the smallest fraction of a percent of human knowledge that we have access to. You know, there's a whole bunch that we're just not, it's just not available. And when I entered the lodge system, I found that to be true. I discovered that there are many private libraries that are sequestered all over the landscape that people aren't even aware exist, where there's tons of material just sitting on the shelves, rotting, not being unused, totally just sitting there unused. Mm-hmm. And it's a real shame.
Oh yeah, it's probably one of the biggest shames of our time. Friderex, my friend, this has been awesome. I'm glad you finally got that book out. I know how hard that can be, and it is full of awesome info. Would you like to remind the people where they can pick that up so you can get the biggest margin on that sale, and also, I guess, your website and podcast?
Yeah, of course, it's at the normal places. Amazon has the book. You can just type in Secret War Inside Freemasonry, Friderex. But we really are directing folks over to our website, middlechambermedia.com, because it's right. It's more direct support for everything we're doing. We have a family. I've had to take serious economic cuts just to get the book out, as you could imagine. And that means taking time off of regular work in order to make it happen. So we are asking folks to buy directly from us because we get the greater margin on the support. It helps us to move forward. I've got some exciting new projects coming from becomealivinggod.com. Look forward to a whole new set of projects from them with Friderex. And of course, I'm always working with freemantv.com. But to get this book, The Secret War Inside Freemasonry, you go on over to middlechambermedia.com. And of course, regular updates of we have podcasts. My wife, Maderex, who's also the editor of the book, her and I, we do podcasts regularly throughout the month of our own over at The Middle Chamber. And you can find that, links to that at the website. And they're constantly being updated all the time. And Greg, thank you for having me on. I'd love to come back on some other time and continue our awesome conversations.
Of course, man. It is always fun. And I'll definitely throw in links with the episode that are the ones that are really going to get you to the book where you are going to get the biggest margin. We can cut out the big, giant corporate middleman. And but it's been awesome. We covered a lot of ground. You never yelled at me, so it's a good day.
I hope you never expected such.
No, but I do wish you well, man. I know you're doing a lot of great work. You're a wealth of information. I know you and Maderex have 4 kids, sometimes making sure that there's a solid revenue stream can get in the way of the research, and as it's designed to do. But you've stayed strong, and you know, I'd really like to see the people connect with you and support what you're doing, even more so than other guests I've had, because I think you're awesome and we are friends, and hopefully they will. So, you know, keep doing what you do, man. Until the next show, take care of yourself out there.
You too, Greg. Farewell, and keep it up, brother. You're fighting the good fight as well, and I'm really excited to know you, man. I'm glad that we are able to do these awesome conversations.
Boom goes the dynamite, people, hitting all the high notes, re-examining all the rumors, and getting some real insight into the things they just don't want us to know. Glad my man finally got the book out. He's a blast to talk to. And after all the things we talked about in the first hour, we went on to elaborate more on the mound builders of ancient America, stories of giant skeletons, ley lines, and natural energy grids, and just what the early colonialists might have known about all that stuff. A possible connection between the Nephilim, the giant skeletons, and humanity's spiritual virus. Suppressed stories from the Book of Enoch, the lore of changelings, more about Albert Pike. And a little something-something my dear friend wrote about that follows some MKUltra funding right back to the Scottish Rite. Yikes. All that and more at thehiresidechatsplus.com. We have no ads, we waste little time, and I don't ask for anything from you guys without giving something back. So double your pleasure, double your fun, and for $5, get a second hour of the show and every show. Now, I'm very psyched about next week's episode, a Valentine's Day special with an accomplished sorcerer, Jason Miller, all about sex magic, not one for the kids. unless you're part of the political, religious, or Hollywood elite. But anyway, two great return guests in a row. How about that? People, you've been too good to me. Thanks so much. Keep listening. I'll keep churning them out. This is Greg Carlwood, punching out, boss. And I'll see you lovers soon. Your move, Scottish Rite.
I'm a walking worst case scenario. Most of the time, I've always crashed and burned. Started out in total confusion, which only got worse with every screw I turned. But as I've gotten older, there's one thing I have learned. As life goes on, you get more and more out of it. I'm more out of it than ever used to be. And they say, you get out of it what you put into it. Out of it is everything to me. A lot depends on how you like yourself. What'll it be? Well done, scrambled or fried? Which affectations seem the least effective will have the greatest effect to reveal the man inside. But don't advertise your affectations, just not dignified. As life goes on, you get more and more out of it. I'm more out of it in every single way. And they say, you get out of it what you put into it. I get more out of it each day. I get more out of it each day.